Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
And Chris Casso.
Hello.
How is everybody today?
Doing okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Just okay.
Okay. Okay.
Nicole's hair is really green.
Still green.
So vibrant.
These weeks.
So vibrant.
Green, babe. So green, babe.
Hey, babe. All
right.
Take a look on the green side.
All right. So, Dark Knight's Metal getting a lot of buzz recently.
It's selling very well.
Yeah, very well.
Apparently, it's big on history.
Yes.
Very referential.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so that leads to the question: what are some strengths and weaknesses of story that are so continuity heavy?
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, because when you sent this, you're like, you don't like it, Nicole, but you are like, eh, or meh.
I'm enjoying it a lot right now.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of good, interesting ranges happening at the store because our coworker Leanne, she kind of has a point too where she's like, I don't know what the hell this is. But then she just told me, she's like, but it kind of makes me want to learn.
Like, it gets her excited. Well,
yeah.
There's so much that it goes over my head that I
right.
feel like I'm just
yeah.
missing every beat.
Right.
So I don't think it's bad, but it's just not for me at the point that I know things.
But I think to a certain extent, if you're looking at like marketability, that can be viewed as a negative.
It could be.
And so let me give a setup to help explain like one of the key things in that.
Yes.
So it's very heavy on Batman, but it's also a Hawkman story. And spoiler, but it, you know, we're like four issues in now, so it's not much of a spoiler. The end of the first main issue, Batman meets the Sandman, the Neil Gaiman Sandman, but not Morpheus, the one that took over after Morpheus. Who do you remember
Michael.
Who this?
Michael?
It's not Michael, it's Daniel.
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 Yes.
And Daniel is
the son of
Hawkman's son. Hawkman's son used to be the Scarab and then became Dr. Fate.
But the mother was the Fury?
Yep, the Fury, yeah. Who in one reality, depending on where you are, she's Wonder Woman's.
Am I going to regret not reading this series now?
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Put it in his box.
So basically, we have Hawkman's grandson, which means it's very important. But it took me a while to remember that was Hawkman's grandson.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's one of those things of like, you either get an instant like, holy bleep. Holy crap. Sorry. Or you, yeah. Or you just kind of like, there's a guy. Was his deal,
right.
You know? And so that's what a lot of the book is, I think. You get just this big range of like, ooh, they got Red Tornado in there versus like, there's a red guy. And depending on the strength of the storytelling, sometimes you don't need to know who that red guy is.
Mm-hmm.
A week ago, I mentioned like there was a really good ending to the Sinestro Corps War where they left you on this panel where you see all these big villains. And if you knew who they all were, you're like, oh my God, this is really wow. But if you didn't know who you were, the storytelling let you know by their placement and importance, like, this looks kind of scary. I think these guys are a big deal. So, again, it's the strength of the storyteller. Like, you know, can you really pull it off? Can you make people care and want to learn more? And right now, I think Dark Metal Knights, whatever, is doing a good job for the most part, straddling that line of giving you action and new things. But we'll have to see if people are willing to read more and learn more. A lot of the event harkens back to an old Grant Morrison story. So it's like, do you really want to go and try and get into Grant Morrison Batman? Because that's a job, you know? It's a job I enjoy. But maybe you just kind of want to read the Wikipedia entry, you know?
Yeah, and I don't feel like this series is trying to be one that is supposed to be new reader friendly. But I think that it depends on what kind of new reader you are. We have a lot of people in the store who are part of our book clubs and our general community who might not understand everything that's happening in a comic, but it does what it did to Leanne, where it intrigues them and they want to go deeper and they start reading some of the back matter and material.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you get a one like me that really wants things just handed to me. And so that's not going to work for me. But I still can see the overarching plot points and the interest. And I still think that there's really good writing in there. there. But I don't think that there's any way that they could do that to really make it new reader friendly. They could drop a couple things here and there. They could do a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Like there was a reveal on one page of a character and they never actually acknowledge who the character is.
Right.
Something small like that they could do.
Yeah.
But I think that its strength actually lies in the fact that it's very referential because it's bringing in a lot of interesting elements and a lot of different characters.
Mm-hmm. For new readers, does it feel like you're... Is it enjoyable just on its face?
Yeah.
Well, like, for example, some of the lead up, there's a couple prelude one-shots going into the Dark Knight's Metal... title. And there were splash pages within those, like one full page, and it was like a thing on there. And I looked at that and I went, that's probably a moment where you go, ah, cool.
Yeah.
And it's totally lost on me. So it would be one of those things where you're like, somebody's making like a political joke and you're like, I get that that's supposed to be funny, but I don't know what the politics are where you're from. You know what I mean?
Gotcha.
It's something like that where you get it's a thing, but you don't get what thing it is.
Right.
So that's what happens. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
And this was an event.
I think it
this
is.
Was it's like, a current
like,
event.
You had like a midnight release party and all that kind of good stuff.
We
and,
did.
And there were posters and special editions and things like that. So they geared up for this.
They geared up quite a bit.
They had a lot of anticipation for this, knowing that it was going to straddle the readership between new and old. And
Because it's also a big Scott Snyder project. Mm-hmm. And the Batman Scott Snyder Fellowship is very big for DC. Batman was under Scott Snyder for the past five years or so. Mm-hmm. It's top-selling book that was in the top 10 sellers of the industry continually. Mm-hmm. So they know that he is a name. Batman will always sell no matter what. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't quite matter how dense it is. And I also feel like there's some editorial behind the scenes. I feel like Geoff Johns is kind of hiding right behind him, being like, put this character here. And Snyder's just like, I don't know who that is. He's like, do it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to know. In a very satanic voice.
It's better if he does his fingers. Yes,
it's like your best Vincent Price. Yes. Go forth. Yeah.
And Snyder's just like, why is Plastic Man in my comic now? He's like, because he fits.
Yeah. You will need him later. Yeah.
Yes. Trust me, you don't even know it, but he will be perfect.
Yes, you know. Yes. It's got so many of these great reveals that I think that if you have any DC stuff under your belt, that you'll find something out of it. Because when I saw the Plastic Man thing, I was like, that's cool.
That's cool.
I'm interested. I want to see what kind of the aftermath will be and stuff like that. So there's definitely points that I think will hit regardless of where you're at with your readership. Unless you're brand spanking new, but you want to like totally throw yourself into something.
Right.
Like, have fun. Go for it. And then maybe backtrack and see like what the little bits are. And if you like homework, like Chris Casso likes sometimes.
Yeah. And it also features the revelation of a new metal in the DC universe called Batmanium. Which
no, you're just making things.
No, I'm
legit.
Not.
Oh, you're
it's
making
legit.
Things.
And that straddles the line of like, well, I kind of do. I like that.
So
no, it that's
is,
goofy.
So
no.
Is Batmanium the Dark Knight's metal?
It's a metal that they haven't talked about, but it was like the final ingredient in getting the plot forward. And they just that one of the bad guys just like, and now for the final metal, Batmanium. the moment I read it, I was just like.
Like so torn.
You had me until Batmanium.
But see, I feel like you're right in the middle. You're like clever or terrible. Like,
it feels like a Silver Age idea.
Yes.
And that's why I'm like, We are talking about a book that features Plastic Man and Hawkman. It's like, okay. I could roll with that. Yeah.
So my question for you, Chris, is this event, how widespread do you think the aftermath will be? Do you think this will be big or...
I think it'll be kind of in the same way that like Multiversity and Final Crisis were, in that there's a lot of leftover ideas that make it feel big, but they'll almost never utilize them properly. There will be things that count, but no one will count them.
So it like opens the door, but people need to actually go get the things out
of
the room.
Exactly. Yeah.
Chris.
Yeah.
But will it be metal?
It should be.
It'll be dark. For at least the next half a year,
they'll milk it afterwards because they're launching a whole new imprint called DC Metals or something like that, where they're going to bring back the Challengers of the Unknown and they're going to do the Terrifics, which is the their Fantastic Four thing. Yeah. So they're going to, it will have a lasting effect in some way or another.
And it just leaves those bits there for people to potentially take it up.
Yep.
Yeah, and we've seen some really good writers come in both publishing houses and take some ideas and go, oh, this is a thing. Yeah. So hopefully that'll happen.
Creative alchemy.
Yes. So, yeah. Cool.
Cool.
Thank you.
All right. So any final thoughts on Dark Knight's metal?
There is a evil multiverse underneath the multiverse full of evil Batman, and that's kind of fun in its own right.
Yeah, and they look pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they look kind of like even more evil destroyers, like from
they
Thor.
They should be on like the cover of a Molly Hatchet album. They just look like metal artwork from heavy metal albums. From
well, and there's 70s. Like there's like a pirate lady kind of looking and stuff. Yeah, they I don't know. They have kind of interesting designs. It can read either cheesy or very metal. Right. It just depends.
It's a whole bunch of Elseworlds, and that in itself is kind of fun. So
cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Speaking of continuity. When I was growing up, there was a comic book strip in the local newspaper, and it was about a family, and the son in the comic strip was the same age as I was, and he went through the same milestones at the same time I did. My mother loved this. She clipped the comics all the time. It was for better or for worse, and I don't even remember the character's name, but like he graduated high school the same time I graduated high school and went to college, graduated college the same time I graduated to college, and I know this because Mom clipped these comics out and mailed them to me.
That's adorable.
And when I was in college. So that got me to thinking about... our lovely comic books here, and is there an analog to that? Are there comics where, over the course of time, people age naturally?
Yeah, usually not in the superhero comics.
In fact, they go to extreme efforts to euthanize.
Yeah,
make them younger, take them back in time.
Yeah,
you know, zap them with a ray that makes them younger and more virile again. Yeah. So.
That's how we get a lot of superheroes.
I was having trouble figuring out a bunch of them, but Hazel from Saga is probably one that we will see age properly throughout time.
Because isn't she not the narrator?
She's the narrator.
She is,
yeah.
So she will be there until the end, and probably when she dies, the story will be over.
Yeah, something like that.
Because he's like that. Vaughn is like that. He will kick Carius kicking and screaming to the bitter end.
Yeah. And I think Carl from Walking Dead is following a normal path.
Yeah.
And all I could think of is those memes of his father making bad jokes at him.
Carl.
Yeah.
Coral.
Coral. Yeah.
Coral.
And then but one of the best examples I thought of was Love and Rockets, specifically the Jaime Hernandez section of it. Jaime? Jamie. Yeah, me. Because there was, he did I don't know if it was a commission or if it's actually going to be a cover, but he did a new image where he took one of the earliest images of his cast where they're all at a bar, and he just did a new version of them at the same bar, and they've all beautifully aged, like all of the fine details of old age going in for his characters, and some of them have passed, so now their photos are in the back of the bar where other people's photos were, and it's the perfect, like, back-to-back of, like, time has passed and the creator has learned how to age everybody appropriately. Mm. And so I think that book is one of the best at representing that and how people change over time,
too. It's a lot more widespread, too. I mean, many years pass in that. Yeah. A lot of times in comics, you only get very short snippets of people's lives.
Yep. Yeah. So for the superhero section, all I could kind of think of was, like, Impulse, Bart Allen, the grandson, not grandson.
Great. Not from the distant
He's in the distant future of Barry Allen. He started off pretty young and he did age pretty well, but there was kind of a weird time jump in something. And then there might have been some de-aging. I can't remember.
But he's not even in the stories anymore, is he?
He is currently not active, which sucks. Yeah. But I felt that he aged along with... Connor Kent, who was mm-hmm. the clone Superboy, and so did Tim Drake. I felt that they all kind of age, but mm-hmm. recently Tim kind of feels like he's kind of stunted, and he's like this permanent, 17, 18, 19, something like that?
I thought he was college.
He's college, yeah, I think he's like early college.
Yeah, so maybe early 20s, early 20s or something.
So he's kind of moving forward. It's kind
but
of
now he's stuck
tricky.
In a room somewhere.
Yeah, he got stuck in the new 52 wash, so a lot of these characters just lost what I loved about them, which was I grew up with them, and mm-hmm. they've aged a bit, and mm-hmm. they've developed as people, and then they've been replaced with other versions of themselves. I'm like, you're not my guy.
Euthanized versions.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
That word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
Yeah. What do you mean?
He's talking about utes. You know, utes.
Su-utes.
The utes-anize.
That's what's... I mean, comics are timeless, and so people in comics will always be... the age the creator wants them to be. You know,
yeah.
Morty from Rick and Morty is always going to be 14, you know.
Right.
Adults generally stay the same ages. Are there any comics just off the top of your head that show a complete life cycle of somebody? The only one I can think of. Cerebus?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 300 issues. And you meet him as a young, poorly drawn, barbarian imitation of Conan all the way to his deathbed.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
All pruny and withered and bitter and misogynist and a perfect reflection of his creator.
Yeah. and some of the characters from Love and Rockets have passed away over time, mm-hmm. so they follow the cycle, mm-hmm. and you got to see them as they were young during some of those cycles, so I'd say that's a pretty good run. But beyond that, I can't really think of too many others.
I feel like the indie world probably has a lot in there, but I just haven't. I mean, yeah. Love and Rockets is one of them, obviously, but... You know,
I never read through Strangers in Paradise,
mm-hmm.
but I imagine they aged most of it.
Yeah, you know what? That book, I have such a love hate for that book. Mm-hmm. I gave up on it, and when I gave up on it, I purged. Because
right.
it started out, I was so excited about this book, and I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't care.
Gotcha.
If they aged or not, I don't care. And I know I'm going to offend a lot of people out there, but
that
book so quickly turned from being a sensible story about two women's struggle for identity and place, and it just turned into a grotesque soap opera, like, overnight. So,
well,
anyway.
Yeah, and there's some that we're currently watching grow up. I mean, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You finish.
Beta, Miss Marvel, you know, like we see her in in high school, and she's going, aging up. And like Giant Days, they're in college, so they started their freshman year, now they're in sophomore year, now they're finishing that up, going into the junior year. So seeing it over a few years, but it's not over a really long period of time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Vagabond. It follows an actual historical figure. If it's Musashi, Miyamoto Musashi. It's been a while since I've read it, so I'm backing out on which historical character, but he's one of the first sword saints of Japan, and it starts with him at his mid-teens, maybe a little bit after that, and he's pretty much rabid. He just wants to kill people, but it follows him as he refines himself into an actual swordsman and takes his lust for violence and turns into a skill for violence. So it is following him age through, so that's... It's a book that follows a cycle,
I think.
So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I wouldn't imagine it to be a very common thing to see people age in real time mm-hmm. in comics. Because, again, that's the beauty of the art form
right.
is that your characters are old and will stay as old as however you want. I saw something recently on the internet where, like, Maggie Simpson is still a baby, but, like, Apu's son is growing up somehow.
Yeah. It's the water in Springfield.
It's the water. Alrighty. Cool. Let's move on to book report, everybody. And Cole Hornaday, let's start with you.
Sure. Well, I read, what is it, the 23rd volume of Invincible, Full House, by Kirkman, Walker, and Fairbairn. You know, I've said before, I thoroughly enjoyed this book. I don't read it monthly, and I think I probably enjoy it more reading it in the collected edition. So this collects issues 127 to 132. I think Kirkman has said he's announced that he's going to wrap this series up.
Yeah.
I think this is getting to the end.
Yeah, he's getting close.
The previous volume, I don't remember what it was called, volume 22, Mark, our protagonist, got zapped back in time and had an opportunity, to a time when he first discovered his Viltrumite superpowers and... you know, he went back and tried to correct some things, sort of course correct the future. And apparently he failed, or at least he just created alternate timelines. Because when he gets home, what he discovers is that he thinks he's been gone for 2 weeks. He's been gone for 5 years. So his little girl that he had with Adam Eve is now 5 years old and doesn't know who her daddy is. Eve has actually been having an affair because she's so lonely with another alien. And the Viltrumites are back, and they are, so you know, the Viltrumites are these Ubermenschian aliens who breed very quickly and are basically designed to conquer. And they can interbreed with any other species, and they'll still come out Viltrumite with different colored skin. So they just you know, bud superhero super beings, and they're bad guys. They're not. So. I don't often revel in a lust for violence, but you know, there are just times where it's like, oh, that person is really, really bad. And I wish that our protagonist would just pinch their head off and, oh, look, they just did it. So,
well, that's done.
Yes. And you know, that's Kirkman for you. There's like, he has no sympathy, and he loves his bloodbaths, and you just get a ton of bloodbaths.
Oh yeah.
In your Invincible
just
stories.
Red all over the pages.
Yeah,
he
just
shows us.
You know, and when the villains are bad and invincible, they're really bad. But you know, they get their comeuppance, they get their heads torn off, they get their limbs torn off, they get their hearts handed to them, fed to them, and it's really, really violent. And I have trouble with violence for the most part, but every once in a while, I just need a cathartic superhero story where the punching is depicted like what people would look like when you really punch someone with superpowers.
And usually the violence in this book serves a purpose.
Precisely.
Of some sort.
And it's not gleeful, and it's not joyful, and it's not done in a tongue-in-cheek manner. I mean, it is, dare I say, realistic violence, but yeah, you see the repercussions.
Have we ever talked about the titles?
Yeah, they're all
TV shows, yeah. Except for the ones that aren't, which throws me off.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Be consistent, man.
Because they'll do Full House, Perfect Strangers, Eight Is Enough, and then The Viltrumite War. It's like, I don't remember that TV show. I want to watch that TV show.
So I enjoy this series. I'm actually, it's going to be okay with me when it concludes. I never bought any individual issues nor the trades. I get them from the library, and I find them to be terribly satisfying. For the reasons I described earlier. And if you've been a fan of Invincible, it's still worth reading, and I am curious to see how it's going to conclude. But I have a feeling that our little family of Mark and his daughter and Eve are going to come out just fine. I think good will ultimately triumph, but I think it's going to be really gory by the time we get to the end.
Are you sure this is a Robert Kirkman book?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Invincible, Full House,
yes,
Volume
sir.
23.
That's right.
Thank you, sir. Nicole, what do you got for us this week?
Well, I'm coming with another fairy tale. This book is called The Little Red Wolf by Amélie Fléchas. It's his French.
Sure. Fléchas.
Sure.
Fléchas.
I don't know.
And we did talk a few weeks ago about Catalyst Prime and Roar Publishing. They do a lot of people of color superhero stuff with their Catalyst Prime. They have another imprint called Cub House, and it's their all-age line. And this is actually published through their Cub House. They've been bringing in European creators and publishing things, which I find really interesting because it's a very different from some of the other stuff they've been publishing. So they're diversifying their line by having diverse characters from all over the place.
Excellent.
So anyway, that's under all done here. So I'll read the back here because I feel like I'm going to want to spoil the whole story. Once upon a time, in the middle of a thick and mysterious forest, stood a strange treehouse, the home of an innocent creature in a red cloak and known to everyone as the Little Red Wolf. That's really short, but sweet and to the point. So it follows it's like a classic story of Little Red Riding Hood, but it's changed. It's not a little girl. It's a little wolf boy, and same sort of thing, bringing something to the grandmother's house, which happens to be
little bunny rabbit?
Dead baby rabbits.
Aww.
It's not very sweet. It's definitely not great for a vegan. But anyway, and then, you know, things go awry. They don't do what they are supposed to do, and they end up getting into some trouble. What is so magnificent about this book is the art style. It's very gorgeous. And while it is a fairy tale book, it's one of those that I think if I was, I mean, I'd want to do it now, but I think as a little kid, I would be poring over the art.
Yeah.
It'd be something that I would grab and say, read it to me again, read it to me again. It is dark. It's a very dark fairy tale, but I don't feel that it does anything that other like Disney films have done and stuff like that. So it's gorgeous. I immediately pre-ordered this when it was available because it was so pretty, and I really didn't see too much of the interior art. You know, it's a pretty straightforward fairy tale. There were a few little bits that were different because it's not a pure Little Red Riding Hood. It's taking that, and as it says on the back, it's turning it on its head. but I think it's really interesting. There's the disparaging thing between wolves and humans, which you see in Little Red Riding Hood too, and some miscommunications maybe as well, you know, which is always a good lesson. But it's beautiful, it's very sweet, and I would definitely recommend picking it up, even if it's just for an art piece, because it's so gorgeous.
Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah. So definitely pick up The Little Red Wolf, published by Cub House, and all illustrated and written by Amélie Fléchet.
Fléchet. All right.
Sorry if I butchered your name. I do it every week.
All right. And Chris Casseau, what do you got for us?
I read a book from First Second Press called Castle in the Stars, The Space Race of 1869. It is by Alex Alice, who previously did for Boom a series of adaptations for Siegfried and the Wagner cycle. This is, if you like Tintin and Hergé?
I would say so. Yeah, Hergé. I've always said Hergé.
And if you like Miyazaki, this is two great tastes that taste great together. He's definitely influenced by Miyazaki. I mean, Castle in the Stars is one of the most Miyazaki titles.
Yeah.
It follows this family who the mother was a scientist who wanted to prove the existence of what she called the aether. Whatever. And A-E-T-H-E-R. Aether, I think.
I think ether.
Ether? Okay.
A and E together is usually E. Right?
Okay. Ether.
You say tomato.
whatever. Say it however you want.
Basically space. She wanted to prove space, and she was going to do it with a hot air balloon. And she disappears, and like a year later, they get a letter from a prince who basically says, I've recovered your wife's logbook. Present yourself to my court, and we will talk about this. And they're immediately being chased by Prussians and other people who have invested interests in this research, and they meet the prince, and he's designing his own way to get into space, and they're going to help him do that. And so there's a lot of political play throughout the book as well. Beautifully illustrated. It's watercolors, and it's just very engaging, very whimsical, and it kind of has that adventure feel of Tintin, and the sense of the beauty of flight and all that kind of stuff that Miyazaki absolutely adores, like in every single one of his things. And like beautiful design work in it as well.
Wow.
So this is the first chapter. There is going to be a second hardcover offered at some point. It's well worth checking out. And it's only $20 for a oversized hardcover with absolutely beautiful artwork.
Yeah, that's a good looking book.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, highly recommend it. If you get a chance, look up Alex Alice, A-L-I-C-E for the last name. He was doing an animated version of some of his artwork, and that is worth watching alone.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Cool. All right. Castle in the Stars. Thank you, Chris. Well, that is Book Report, and that is our show, and coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comic Extension here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsengine.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. This week, the questions come to us from me.
What?
And I will admit that I had forgotten. I assigned myself questions until
nice
about
job.
3 o'clock today.
Well, you've been busy with Sketchfest.
I have been busy with Sketchfest. And so I basically decided to try to find, because I like writing questions about movies, and I tried to find, I looked on Wikipedia, what movies have 5 installments?
Oh,
and
my.
I found one, and so I'm going to be reading you questions about each one of the Transformers movies.
Oh, no.
It was either that or Die Hard.
Oh, no.
Maybe Die Hard will be next. Okay. Keep in mind, I've only seen the first one, and I did not like it. Okay. Number one, Transformers 2007. The film's tagline, "Their War, Our World," is not genuine to the Transformers, but was originally slated to be the tagline of what other film?
Oh.
Alien vs. Predator?
Yes!
From 2004.
All right. Number two, Transformers Revenge of the Fallen from 2009. As of 2011, this film holds a dubious record for the highest number of what in a movie?
Racial caricatures?
Explosions?
All good answers, but no. I'm going to give you a hint. Bumblebee wants you to drink a Coke.
Oh, right. Sponsors.
Paid product placements, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yikes.
Wow. All right. Okay. And that's terrible. 47 was the
wow.
number.
Wow.
So I'm assuming that's 47 different companies, not like 47 like cans of Coke.
And right. Yeah.
All right. Number three, Transformers, Dark of the Moon, 2011. Peter Cullen returns as the voice of Optimus Prime, but I will never get over the fact that he also voices this pessimistic, gloomy, depressed, old gray cartoon stuffed donkey.
Eeyore.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
All right. Number C, these are Transformers questions. I put in Eric.
Well done. Well done.
You do what you gotta do, man. Yeah.
Exactly. Transformers Age of Extinction from 2014. Ugh. Original designs for Grimlock, the Dinobot Tyrannosaurus Rex, gave him 3 claws on each forearm. In the movie, though, he only has 2 claws. Why?
Oversight?
No.
It's easier to animate 2 than 3. Yeah.
No. The answer is actually a lot more interesting. Huh. A discovery in 1989 proved that the actual T-Rex only had 2 claws on its forearms. Mm-hmm. Though up until that time, paleontologists thought they had 3.
Wow.
So they were...
They wanted to
they
get
were
that
being
accurate.
They were wanting to get that accurate.
Oh, wow.
All right.
Michael Bay is friend to archaeologists.
That's right.
And finally, Transformers The Last Knight, 2017. John Turturro reprises his role as Agent Simmons and is joined by John Goodman and Steve Buscemi as the voices of Hound and Day Trader, respectively. What 1988 Coen Brothers film had these 3 actors throwing strikes in a bowling alley together?
1988?
The Big Lebowski.
The Big Lebowski.
Wait, Big Lebowski's from 88?
1988. Really?
Wow.
Yeah.
No.
I looked it up.
No.
Maybe I wrote that. Maybe it's 98. Maybe I wrote that down wrong.
This is just rattling your world.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you know what year The Big Lebowski was released, send us an email, perfectbombpodcast@gmail.com. That is Book Report, and that is our show. That is Book Report. That is quiz time, and that is our show.
We did a lot of things tonight.
And we will see you next week.